Thank you for that wonderful introduction. Thank you so much for coming out on kind of a mixed evening. I was watching the weather all day long. Over in Bury St. Edmund, where I live, it was sunny, but as we got closer to Cambridge, it looked rainy. Now, time permitting, because everyone's fussy here about time, I have to stop everything at 7 o'clock, but I'm hoping that there are two people here tonight who like to read poetry, because if time remains at the end, there's two poems I would like to ask people to hear, and I'm hoping that you'll think about volunteering when I get to that point. I don't like to read poetry myself. I think it's my accent that I don't like, mostly. There you are. Okay, so art and ethics, how they may connect. A woman arrived at the gate of heaven, and while she was waiting for St. Peter to greet her, she sort of peeked through the bars, and she saw a beautiful banquet table. Incredibly, sitting around this banquet table were her parents, other ancestors, and all of the people who she had loved and who had died before her. At one point, they looked up and they noticed her, and they began calling out greetings to her, waving, "Hello, how are you? We've been waiting for you. Good to see you." When St. Peter came to the gate, the woman, who was evidently very moved by all this, said, "This is such a beautiful place. How do I get in?" St. Peter says, stroking his beard, "Well, you have to spell a word," St. Peter said. And she said, "Oh, well, what word would that be?" And St. Peter said, "Love." So the woman correctly spelled love, and St. Peter welcomed her into heaven. This is bad theology, we all know that. But there she is, and about a year later, Peter came up to the woman and asked her to watch the gates for him that day. Now, while the woman was on the gates, her husband arrives. "I'm surprised to see you," the woman said. "How have you been?" "Oh, I've been doing pretty well since you died." He's American. He replied, "For instance, I married that sexy young thing that took care of you. You know, that nurse, while you were sick? And then after we got married, I won big on the lottery. And you know that dingy little house that we used to have? We sold that and I bought a huge mansion just outside of Dallas. Now my new wife and me, why, we traveled all around the world. We were on holiday, in fact, today, as I recall, in Cancun. And I was water skiing and I must have fallen and hit my head." And then he looked around and he looked through those bars and he says, "Say, this looks great. How does a feller get in here?" So she says, "Well, you have to spell a word." And he said, "Oh, what's the word?" She paused for a moment. She said, "Czechoslovakia." Now, I tell you this silly but apt story to get you thinking about ethics. Our culture's ethics, our neighbor's ethics, our own ethics. Now, I'm going to come back to the jealous wife presently. But first, tonight, I want to discuss the potent, but I think the often undervalued role that art plays in forming people's ethics. You see, I believe that art is the mother of civilization. That sounds clever. What does it mean? Well, a quote from Jonathan Jones, art commentator for The Guardian, and sometimes jurist for the prestigious Turner Art Prize, may clarify that for us. He argues that art is evidence of civilization. Jones points to the earliest cave paintings, saying, "The art is so superb in quality that it proves the existence of a higher mind, leading to the capacity to create civilization." The German philosopher Friedrich Schiller put it this way, "Art has made us men because it is a means to a higher moral end." Now, speaking of a means to a moral end, let's begin by considering the ethics of the Hebrew tribes around the time of their exodus from Egypt, when they were coming out of slavery. Now, I have to concede right here that I could have begun a lot earlier than the Hebrews. India, for example, China, Egypt, Babylon, ancient civilizations all had codified ethics well before the Hebrews were even a people. But I begin with these 12 tribes because of the special relationship between their Decalogue and much of Western ethics. Now, in other words, the Ten Commandments and not Hammurabi's Code are universally construed as the basis of our Western ethics. That's why I start with the Hebrews. Now, note that in Exodus and in other Old Testament books, after the Decalogue was presented to Moses, one of the first directives was to decree that these laws should be preserved in an ark placed in an aesthetically pleasing and quite splendid tabernacle made of precious things like stones and metal, gold, precious woods, all costly fabrics, all very rare. Now, I think we here today would probably pay good money to go up to London to see such a beautiful thing, and we probably would regard it as art, even though they probably would have just thought of it as craft. But my point is not lost. This was aesthetically pleasing. This was something beautiful. Furthermore, the ark was guarded by sculptures. Two golden cherubim, beautiful to behold and awesome in design, and described in Exodus 26, if you ever want to see exactly what the ingredients were. Now, let's briefly consider the ethics of those commandments, which were contained inside of this aesthetically pleasing setting. Dr. Tom Wright states in Virtue Reborn, as a code of ethics, the Ten Commandments are ethics that are more or less universal and constant, and that they are easy to comprehend. Incidentally, the larger point that Wright goes on to make is that in addition to their being pervasive, the Ten Commandments are also impossible to keep. Just tuck that away in the back of your mind. I'm going to come back to that point. Putting Wright's telling observation aside for now, though, in addition to creating a code of ethics, the Decalogue, the Ten Commandments, gave birth to a new culture. Indeed, Professor John Bright of Union Theological Seminary argues that the Decalogue represents a central element in the covenant that brought Israel into being as a people. I want to think about the aesthetics. You know, what is the deal with the aesthetics? The Hebrews might just have gone in for Danish functionality by constructing a strong but plain brick and tin container characterized by sharp angles and primary colors, rather something like IKEA might sell. But, and this is a big caveat, they felt that their code of ethics were so special that they used art as a metaphor to proclaim to all and sundry the power, the majesty, and the substance of those Ten Commandments. Now, are you seeing this symbiosis now? Not unique to Hebrews, but there's this symbiotic relationship between this high aesthetic and the high ethics, taken in the light of what we're trying to establish here as art as mother of civilization. So now that, in my mind at least, I've briefly connected art and ethics, and certainly I'm going to ask you now if you all will grip your seats very firmly, because we're about to take a leapfrog into the first century of the Common Era to consider the Sermon on the Mount, and to see to what extent, and even if, the Sermon on the Mount affected the art and the ethics of Rome. Now, to be sure, the first emperor of Rome, Augustus, is well known for being a self-proclaimed restorer of the Republic. In other words, he was a highly principled and a highly moral man, and he believed in chastity and piety. He would have made a good Christian in many ways, according to many historians. And not surprisingly, he introduced a number of moral and political reforms in order to improve Roman society and to try to formulate a new Roman government and lifestyle, trying to replicate the golden era that he felt was gone. And the basis of each of these reforms was to make the state and the people in the state more moral. This was his idea. However, as with all attempts to legislate morality, his decrees failed to modify the behavior of his subjects. For instance, the popular ethics of Rome in his day was mirrored in his hedonistic fine art, from sculpture to poetry, as Rome's artists and writers and poets actually pushed a prurient ethic contrary to the emperor's decrees. It was a counter-agenda. Art of Love by Roman poet Ovid is just as sexy as some of the love advice that you'd read in the newspapers today, maybe even more so. Themes in his writings include seduction, adultery, and lewd humor. Ovid, and I'm quoting here, Ovid stipulates in a businesslike fashion that promising the moon is a helpful way to a girl's bedroom, and even if women resist, they want to have sex, so men should force themselves upon them. But as Christian ethics flowed up from the Middle East like a benign virus, they create a tipping point that infects Rome's grassroots ethics with telling results. Now, for those of you who aren't quite sure what tipping point means, because we hear that a lot, let me explain just briefly. A tipping point is that point at which a series of small and incidental changes become significant enough to cause a larger, more important change. This is exactly what happened when the gospel message began to float up, as I said, like a virus. Take Rome's tombs, for example. Those of you who have been to Rome have probably seen many of them. These, first and foremost, show that among the Romans, even before the Christians turned up, there was a concept of an afterlife. But that place was usually reserved for the very few worthies who deserved the reward. Ordinary folks like you and me, we could hardly expect to go to heaven. See, well, you could hardly hope for any kind of reward in the afterlife. And this led to a general pessimism and an aversion towards death, with few exceptions. And their art reflects this. Gosh, it sounds an awful lot like modern Western society today, doesn't it? So typical Roman burial art might include handsome carvings along with this poignant lament: taken in the prime of her life, now food for worms. Pretty pessimistic, but pretty typical. However, after the Christian message came, burial art began to reflect a radically new set of values, this time based on the Gospels, and soon the widespread pessimism begins to give way to hope. Tombs now declared dead to the world, but alive to God. Radically new message. At last, all men and women, who hardly had a look in the afterlife, unless they happened to be married to an emperor. Now, men and women could be assured of a better life to follow this one. And the message was in the art. Early Christian art, of course, had other purposes, including giving instructions to new converts, as well as extolling the virtues of baptism and other sacraments. From the catacombs to the opulence of St. Peter's, one sees this kind of art all over Rome. I would suggest a new ethic was born as the result of that art. Symbiotically, then, there's that symbiosis again for you biologists out there. You must really be digging that. But in art and in culture and in ethics, the symbiosis is there. So symbiotically, the more the Goths, the Picts, the Visigoths, the Celts, and the Britons saw and heard this egalitarian message of the life of Christ spread throughout the Roman Empire through art, the more they came under its influence. Now, of course, this movement that I'm describing did not always lead to harmony. Particularly if there are any historians here, you know you can challenge me right here and pretty well debunk me, so let me jump in right where you might be thinking right now. See, on the contrary, as art began to spread, it began also to create schisms over the ensuing decades, including the Byzantine iconoclasm around AD 750. Now, this iconoclasm constituted an all-out ban on religious images, and it was accompanied by a widespread destruction of icons and persecution for anyone using certain kinds of art to express Christian faith. Now, those of you who do know your history will know this is what led to the split between the West and the East. And that split, of course, is still felt to this day. Split is a euphemism. It was a blooming rupture. Painful. Split is right down the middle. And yet, two things come to mind as I think about it. First of all, I'm thinking about the long and the sad history of interdenominational warfare. But, remember what Tom Wright said? He pointed it out. Despite having what is essentially an impeccable set of standards encoded in the Ten Commandments and understood in the light of the Gospels, we Christians continue to fail miserably when trying to live up to such high principles, even within our own families. Think of that jealous wife meeting her former husband at the gates of heaven that I mentioned at the start of the talk. You know, the funny thing is, my wife dropped me off a couple of, about a mile or so up the road, so because of the traffic here. And as I was walking here, I was full of pious thoughts and how, you know, I wanted to come across as so godly and I want to be a great inspiration to people. And I have to tell you, I am rabidly phobic when it comes to the cyclists of this town because I'm always afraid I'm going to be mowed down. Now, I'm on a pavement and this guy is coming zizzing towards me on the pavement. Or this is my turf. And I thought, oh, I won't tell you exactly what I thought, but I'm not going to move. And I held my ground. And this guy whizzed right past me. And I immediately thought, how could I be so stupid? Why didn't I just graciously step aside? Maybe I had a real good reason for being on the sidewalk. Right? I'm supposed to be the pious guy coming to give the talk at the round church. And I've got murder on my mind. Thank you, Tom Wright. Thank you, Jesus. You know, I have to tell you this, too. I'm going to drop a name here. I got to be pretty friendly when I was the religious programs organizer for BBC Radio Oxford back in the 80s and the 90s. I got to be friendly with Richard Harries, who happened to be our bishop. Bishop Richard Harries, quite a man. Interesting fellow. He told this story. He told a story, and I'll truncate it, of a fellow who was cast away in the South Seas on an island, which was known to be uninhabited, and to his great delight, when he got on this island, not only did he find clean water and vegetables growing and enough food for him to survive, the coolest thing about it all was he found that the rock on the island was very soft and he could carve it. So knowing that he was probably going to be here for the rest of his life, he decided he would, this is Richard Harry's joke, I got nothing against Welsh people, if you happen to be Welsh, he was a Welsh fellow, so he decided to reconstruct his tiny little Welsh village right here on this south Pacific Island. And blow me down, in 40 years, he had a town that looked exactly as though it came out of one of the valleys. Now, an Australian ship was going by one day, and they saw smoke curling up, and they knew this was an uninhabited island. So out of their curiosity was piqued, they went ashore, the captain went ashore maybe with the first mate, and they were looking at this incredible, this little Welsh village here in the middle of nowhere. And then they saw very hairy, very odd-looking, haunted man turns up. It's, oh, he says, welcome to my village. Oh, they said, is this your village? Yes, he says, this is my village from South Wales. And he says, I'll show you around. And he's old by this time, is why it sounds so croaky. He says, this is my library. Richard Harries told this joke. He's not known for telling jokes. This is my town hall. There's the school where I went. And they went all down through the village, and then there were two churches faced off at the end of the town. And so the captain says, well, I see you have two churches. Why do you have two churches here? He says, oh, he says, this is the church where I go, and this is the church where I don't go. We have schism, you know, we're hardwired for being sinful. And I'm saying that, thankfully, despite all of this dissension and these schisms, thank God Christian art survived that. And it continued to grow, and it cross-fertilized more kinds of art until I think it reached its apex sometime in the late Middle Ages. Now, especially noteworthy in this particular period are the beautiful cathedrals and churches of Europe, rather like the building that we're in here. Although this is Norman, so this is an early example, but this is a gorgeous place to be. And I want to say that there's more than just good architecture to churches. Stay with me now, because we're thinking of art. I am a frequent attender of Evensong and Morning Eucharist at the Cathedral of St. James in Bury St. Edmunds, where I live. And the art of the choral tradition in that cathedral keeps alive the idea of the utter holiness of God packing its own special potency. Johann Sebastian Bach, incidentally, knew this potency. But music was never just music to Bach. Nearly three-quarters of his 1,000 compositions were specifically written for use in worship. And between his musical genius and his utter devotion to Christ and the effect of his music, in some circles, he's come to be known as the fifth evangelist. I can believe that. The Reverend Dr. Frances Ward, who is our wonderful dean at the cathedral, writes in her extraordinary book, Why Rousseau Was Wrong, she writes that, if that's for me, I just left, incidentally, music is part of a tradition enabling others to worship. The anthems and the chants and the hymns provide an artistic inheritance of emotional and moral depth that grows as we mature. This better be turned off, too. Yeah, thank goodness that's turned off. How poor is what I'm trying to say we would be without music. It's not just about the sculptures and the stained glass window. But on a personal note, I'm often struck how my mind is more clearly focused on God as I gaze at the scenes depicted in the rich red sapphire and green stained glass windows in our cathedral. And when I recite the creed, as we do, we actually turn east. We turn east and we recite the creed. And as I do that, I look right up and I can see the creeds in the stained glass window. So as I'm saying the creeds, it's almost like being illiterate and I'm reading it right up there. Now, I have to say, lest you think that I'm wedged in a 1662 Anglican time and space continuum where fusty old Thomas Cranmer and Hugh Latimer preside over an eternally all-white never-never land, I must confess that despite my being a born-again Christian, I remain a confirmed Catholic, a closet Baptist with strong Pentecostal leanings. And I am moved in exactly the same way. Mark this. I am moved in exactly the same way whether I'm listening to Graham Kendrick strumming his electric guitar while leading worship as I am when I hear Gregorian chant or even a great old Sankey hymn. It's all art. It is also a powerful agent of change. See, devotional music woos the Holy Spirit. And here's a word for all of you budding apologists studying here at the Round Church. Where the Holy Spirit is, there you find the church growth that we all desire. Now here's a news headline that frankly surprised me when I read it this past December 2013. I read this in the Church of England newspaper, and this may surprise you. Here's the headline. Startling academic research shows widespread church growth in Britain. It's not an oxymoron. I'll read on. An international team of leading researchers based at Cranmer Hall, Durham, have just published a study entitled Church Growth in Britain from 1980 to the present. Here are just a few of the extraordinary statistics that have been found. There are 500,000 Christians in black majority churches in Britain. 60 years ago, there were none, or hardly any. At least 5,000 new churches have been started in Britain since 1980, and this is an undercount. The true figure, probably much higher. There are 1 million Christians in Britain from black, Asian, and other minority ethnic communities. Now, I do not have the words to tell you the buzz that I get when I have been in London worshiping at one of the Afro-Caribbean churches that predominantly are referred to in this particular study. And it's true that white guys like me may not be able to dance to that energetic kind of music, but I can certainly do a mean Davidic jig when that spirit comes on me. It's happened. And it is mind-boggling. But art is not just an individual experience, because I just shared an individual response. I'm not saying everybody should or even would respond that way. But neither is it limited to just one artistic genre. Art, like ethics, has the potential to impregnate entire cultures, or it ought to. Consider the point about literature made by Clemens Sedmak. He's professor for social theology and social ethics at King's College London. In an article published in Israel Affairs, he discusses Pope Benedict's visit to the synagogue in Rome in 2010, during which time the Pope spoke of ways in which Jews and Christians, on the basis of the shared ethics of the Ten Commandments, may join forces to influence secular society. Sedmak, in picking up Benedict's point, stresses, among other things in the article, the imperative of using art to keep alive the fact of the Holocaust, alleging it is a wound of Europe that must never heal. He avers that Christians may tell future generations of the death factories, citing the power of novels that deal with what happens when the past is forgotten. His point being, such stories create an ethics of memory. I wish I had coined that term myself. An ethics of memory that does not allow us to forget past evils. He says, what we forget and what we remember is not irrelevant. It makes a difference to the way we act as individuals and in the context of a community. Now we've touched on ethics in sculpture, music, novels, but what about poetry? Still thinking about two people to come up and read this. We've touched, as I said, on everything but poetry. Let's talk about poetry for a moment. There aren't many modern Christians today writing what we would call modern poetry. Now, a lot of poetry being written is very good, very high standard. I think of the late Jack Clemo, who is a Welsh, just sorry, boy, he'd shoot me if he heard that, a Cornish poet, blind and deaf since childhood. And his poetry is stunning. If you can ever come across Jack Clemo's poetry, I would suggest that you read it. But much of our poetry really just is an echo of Victorian poetry, at least in my experience. But I want you to remember that modern poetry, poetry as we understand it today, actually was popularized by T.S. Eliot, who converted to Christianity and wrote, among other things, well, you know about The Wasteland, but he also wrote four quartets, which deals with the themes of incarnation, time, and eternity, spiritual insight, and revelation. And, of course, he always comes back to Pentecost. Now, we can all argue the relative merits of Eliot, whose work certainly isn't to everyone's liking. But we can, and I think we should agree, that it's his ability to turn his convictions into poems that affected the 20th century. And it is worth us thinking about that tonight. As editor of Christianity Today wrote, Mark Galley, wrote of Eliot, he says that Eliot didn't believe society should be ruled by the church, only by Christian principles, with Christians being the conscience of the nation. Now here again, for those of you who are ready to debunk me, I know what many of you are thinking. I am not attempting for one moment to claim more for Christianity than it deserves. No religion has a monopoly on the ethics market. I'm at pains to make that clear. Moreover, it is hard to communicate our ideas in words to people outside of our sphere of influence. Robin Gill, professor of modern theology in the University of Kent at Canterbury, believes that we, living today as postmodernists, exist only in local cultural linguistic communities. Now, from within these communities, we can discover values and truth, he concedes, but these are not values and truths which are accessible to others outside of these communities. So, in other words, in the postmodernist age, we lived in closed hermeneutical circles. I understand that. And, you know, he may be right about closed hermeneutical circles. But, and I wouldn't be here tonight, actually, if I didn't believe this, I believe it is possible, and it is ill-advised for Christians to be frightened by this. It is possible for Christian artists and writers to attempt to influence the way other people think and act. Art, you see, often contains divine, creative and redemptive imagery only waiting to be known and rendered into ethics by a discerning audience. Redemption may be seen and experienced in the most unlikely places and genres. Check this out. You can see it in films by the Coen brothers, by Steven Spielberg, George Lucas, Richard Attenborough, and Stanley Kubrick, just to name a few. If you don't see something of God in their films, maybe you're not looking close enough. Many people do. They just don't have the vocabulary to articulate it. In An Experiment in Criticism, C.S. Lewis picks up on this very point, and he says that art is most valuable, that is, awe-inspiring, when we may recognize its numinous quality. Lewis argues that myths, as well as some modern fictional works that have a mythical quality, such as Stevenson's Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, Kafka's The Castle, and I would add to his list the works of Graham Greene, Saul Bellow, and even J.K. Rowling. Such are what Lewis calls, quote, a particular kind of story which has value in itself, a value independent of its embodiment in any literary work. We're back to Eliot's Pentecost. This is beyond us. All we have to do is be the disciplined artists, the poets, the writers, the ones who are willing to actually risk to create in such a way and then not try to manipulate. Just let the Holy Spirit do the rest of the work. Since someone observing a piece of art, whether it's a play that you've written or a short story or a poem, someone observing a piece of art may be deeply affected, even if only on a subliminal level. And there's no reason why art created by Christians may not cut across those multiple hermeneutical circles, speaking volumes to the observer about our God, particularly among the growing numbers of contemporary men and women who, while not being particularly religious, are still hungry for a true spiritual experience. I was talking with David before we came out here, and I said, we're due for something like the Schaeffers ran into. The Schaeffers in the late 40s and early 50s were born for the Jack Kerouac beats because what they had to offer just seemed perfect for the kinds of minds that Kerouac and the rest of the beatniks and then the hippies were seeking. And then we went into this dull period in the 80s and the 90s when it all seemed to just go pear-shaped. And I said to David, I think we're due. You know, a place like the Round Church, if you would invest as much energy and art in this place as you do in your apologetics courses, I think you would see the fruit that Lewis and Eliot and others who I've talked about are referring to. It's just me speaking, of course, but that's how I feel about it. You see, I'm one of these funny guys that believes people would rather see a sermon than hear one. Maybe you're a little bit like me. I don't know. I'll tell you this. If that's the case, then artists may just be more effective than preachers in spreading the gospel in the next 20 years in this country. Think about that one. Now, time is running out. I've got to bring this thing to a close. I think my watch stopped. What time is it? Yeah, good. That means somebody's going to come up here and read some of this poetry in a moment. Okay, so if you feel as I do, even remotely, that you have something important to share with contemporary society, then we who are artists and musicians and writers and filmmakers should share our ideas, even if the wider culture, i.e. our so-called postmodernist culture, appears unreceptive, even hostile. Because to do otherwise would be to put our lights under the proverbial bushel basket. Perhaps Plato's Republic, which contains the allegory of... Was that for Plato? Did we get an applause for Plato just then? Who clapped? Just dropping off. Okay. Probably everybody will know the allegory of the cave, but if not, it's found in Book 7 of the Republic. It'll just turn your head around. Now, with apologies to Plato for my synopsis, the story, essentially, for those of you who don't know it, tells of several prisoners who have been chained up in a cave since birth and actually never going outside the cave. So, obviously, they see only a wall in the cave, and it's impossible for them to appreciate that there's an entrance where light from an outside world is pouring in. Nevertheless, from time to time, animals and people and birds and other objects pass by the entrance, and it casts a shadow up on the wall. And understandably, the prisoners comprehend the shadows as reality. It's reality. It's solid reality, even though it's just a shadow. Now, in time, one of the men breaks free from his chains and he leaves the cave. Encountering the outside world, he suddenly appreciates that it is far beyond the mere shadows he had previously understood. He now knows there are authentic men and birds and animals, not just shadows. So he decides to return to tell the good news to the men who are still prisoners. Of course, they know better, and they doubt him. They bid him to leave. Soon they're angry at him. They want him to leave, and if they can get their hands on him, they'll kill him for suggesting such heresy. Now, when we artists, when we share our ideas with our society, the wider society around us here today, modern Britain, modern Australia, modern New Zealand, the whole of the Western world, parts of the Far East, when we share what we believe, what we know, aren't we a little bit like the man who escaped from the cave? See, we're faced with the daunting task of using art to tell people that there is more, much, much, much more to know than what is offered by the light they have, be it based on their prejudices, the prevailing conventions of their cultural, linguistic communities, or dare I say this, even their own experiences. All right, let's just settle for a minute. Together, we artists and our patrons, and we need them. If we have time for a Q&A, somebody bring up the question of patrons. Together, we artists and our patrons may confidently engage our contemporaries. We may confidently. History set the precedent. Eliot turned the poetry world on its head. Bach turned the music world on its head. Albrecht Dürer converted to Protestantism and absolutely reinvented the way people saw art and nature. So the precedent has been set. We may confidently engage our contemporaries, but be warned. A life dedicated to the arts requires a moral obligation to a set of special ethics of our own. First, a lifetime dedicated to mastering our talent. There is no such thing as microwave talent. There was a man from Texas who was working here in the United Kingdom. I'm told this is a true story, sir. Now, you can judge for yourself whether you believe this. And he, knowing that the Brits, unlike the Americans, Americans like to warm their houses. The Brits like to warm parts of their bodies. So thinking about this, he came up with an invention, a microwave fireplace. Huh? So he got this thing together, and it looked workable, so he went to the patent office in London, and he was seen by the committee, and they grilled him, and he really gave as well as he got. And they were just on the brink of giving him a patent for this when one bright spark said, excuse me for asking this, but what does one actually do with a microwave fireplace? And the fellow said, oh, I'm glad you asked. He says, with my invention, you can now spend a whole evening in front of the fire in just 3 minutes. You can't have microwave talent. It takes a lifetime to master your talent, writers. You wouldn't know this, by the way, if you ever read Christian novels or Christian poetry or heard some Christian music. You wouldn't even remotely think that they heard that you actually have to bleed over your art. And I'll tell you, I believe this is why artists today, Christian artists, aren't even mocked. You know, we aren't even good enough to mock. People only mock those who threaten them. It's why evangelists come in for so much mocking in the media. They're scary. Christian artists, they don't even bother with us. A lifetime dedicated to mastering our talent. You said that already. Did you believe my story about the microwave fireplace? I just made it up. It dawned on me as I was speaking. Second, it requires an authentic understanding of the other cultural linguistic communities we hope to reach. I think the Pipperts, Wesley Pippert, a few years ago wrote a remarkable little book called Out of the Salt Box. We've got to get out of our little Christian huddles, our little Christian salt boxes. You know, if we don't pay attention to the other cultural linguistic circles out there, we're going to continue being the greatest people on earth for answering all the questions that absolutely nobody is asking. Seems a rather sad thing. How would you like to show that to God on Judgment Day? I gave you this talent and you didn't bother to develop it. We have got to tap into the other cultural linguistic communities if we hope to reach. And finally, we have to have a mature willingness to accept. This is where I don't get invited back to the round church ever again when I say this. This is with trepidation. I'm going to heighten the drama. I'm going to go back. Repetition of the theme is a very, very useful artistic technique. You get it a lot in music, I'm sure of that. Let me repeat myself. First, a lifetime dedicated to mastering our talent. Second, an authentic understanding of the other cultural linguistic communities we hope to reach. Thirdly, and finally, we have to have a mature willingness to accept that even after our best efforts, like the men who preferred captivity in the cave, many people will not be convinced by us.